Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, an adaptation of which medieval instrument is still played in Brazil, but no longer played in Portugal? Dr. Judith Cohen is an ethnomusicologist based in Toronto, where she teaches at York University. She's done extensive work in the area of Judeo-Spanish Sephardic music and its relationship with other traditions, such as Balkan, Yiddish, and medieval Iberian music, and Pan-European balladry. She has also done extensive research on the music of the Raya, the border area between Spain and Portugal, where many Jews settled to escape from the Inquisition and continued to practice their traditions as crypto-Jews. In her seminars and performances, Judith sings songs from all of these sources and also accompanies herself on traditional string, wind, and percussion instruments. As a frequent guest on this program, Judith has spoken with us about different aspects of this music and her research. This week, she's speaking with us about her latest interest, the music of the descendants of Portuguese and Moroccan Jews in the Brazilian Amazon. Thank you very much for speaking with us again, Judith. Could you tell us about your new project in Brazil? First of all, how did it happen to come about?
Hi, it's always a pleasure, Linda. What happened was, during the pandemic, people often start saying things by during the pandemic, I got an email from someone who said, you won't remember me probably, but I'm from Brazil and I heard you and your daughter sing at the World Congress of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem in 1997. That was a great opening. And I thought maybe you could give us a talk online about music of the Jews of Morocco, because most of us are descended from the Jews of Morocco. And we talked about it and we set a date. It was pandemic time. You're home. You've got time. I was used to doing Zooms from my living room. So I said, sure. And I did it. They were really happy that I could do it in Portuguese, even though it was from Portugal, Portuguese and not Brazilian. And then I said to them, well, who's doing the ethnomusicology of music among the Moroccan Jews of the Amazon? Because I knew about them, but I'd never gone. I'd always thought, well, Brazil's so big. How am I going to get around and so on? And he said, what's ethnomusicology? And I explained, and he said, nobody as far as I know, but I'll ask around. And so I asked for I can get one small grant a year from the university as part of my part-time faculty benefits for research. And so I got a little research grant and a conference travel grant. There was a conference on Sephardic studies in Rio de Janeiro, and I coordinated that, and I set off to Brazil. That was 2 years ago. It was August 23.
So what did you do there?
Well, I wanted to go to Recife, as they say, first, because that's where the first Jews of the Americas set up the first official synagogue. I mean, people had synagogues in their houses and so on, but the first dedicated building as a synagogue in the Americas was in Recife. And I thought, well, at least I wanted to go and pay a visit there. And I mentioned it to somebody that I met at the World Congress of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem recently, though, not 20 years earlier, and he said, oh, I'm going to connect you to one of the professors at the university, and maybe you can give a lecture. And so I did, and he arranged for me to stay just for a few days, but it was a very crowded few days. And at the lecture that I gave, before I had been in Brazil for even 24 hours, I explained what contrafactum is, you know, adapting words of a given set of lyrics to a melody that you already know, a different melody. It's very common in all cultures, but very, very common in Jewish culture. And I was explaining that. And afterwards, a group of people put their hands up, kind of middle-aged people, I guess. And one of them said, well, we're crypto-Jews, and we do this contrafactum thing, but we didn't know it was called contrafactum. And I said, from the stage, I said, oh, do you want to sing it something for me? And they immediately started singing. And I immediately whipped out my phone and started filming them. And the professor immediately moved his phone on the tripod around and started filming me filming them. And that's where it became a double project right away, because that's how I met the crypto Jews, who are not very crypto, I mean, in the sense of secret. Obviously, if you wave your hand at a university auditorium and say, hi, we're crypto Jews, then secrecy is not a big part of your auto definition.
So what did they mean by crypto Jews?
They just meant that they were descended from the conversos of Portugal. Some probably weren't. Most probably were or are. They have their own communities. They all consider themselves Jewish, whether they've officially become Jewish or not.
So tell us about these two branches, let's say, of the research that you've been doing.
So I went to the Amazon. When I say I went to the Amazon, it sounds as if I, you know, took boats and canoes and put on lots of bug repellent and so on. But no, I went to the two main cities where there are still Jews living. There are scattered Jews living here and there around the Amazon, but the two real communities are in Manaus, which is the capital of Amazonas, and Belém do Pará, which is your first port of entry if you're going to cross the Atlantic. Belém is what you're going to hit first. So that's where the two communities really are. There's still, you know, bits and pieces here and there around the Amazon, but and several, of course, who have moved to São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro or outside Brazil altogether, but that's, you know, the centers. So I spent several days in each of those places, but I had contacted people earlier, and we had had Zooms, and I had done some field work with them already over Zooms. And so when I got there, a lot of us knew each other, and we hadn't met in person. But it was very exciting, and I was trying to find out what Moroccan repertoire they still had, if they had any. And as far as I can see, they've maintained a lot of the liturgy. They've put quite a lot of effort, in fact, into finding men who, you know, Hazanim, who sing the old Moroccan liturgy, and they sing it in Brazil. But in terms of secular music, the women's songs, wedding songs, the narrative ballads, the romances, and so on, I didn't find anything.
When did these people settle there from Morocco, and how did they happen to end up there?
Right. They have been there. I mean, the current people have not been there since then, but the community has been there since 1810. So Brazil became independent. It opened for business, as it were, formally. It, you know, sent out notices saying, we're open for business, literally. People of any religion could live there. And at the same time, in Morocco, there was very little work. There was a lot of anti-Semitism. And at first, it was mostly young Jewish men who heard about this and said, well, let's see what this is about, you know. The ones who weren't married yet, who didn't have a family that they had to immediately provide for, they could do it. They could get up and they could go, and they did. And they did everything. They learned how to use the small boats and even make the small boats. They became, many of them, peddlers. They worked in the sugarcane trade. Later on, they worked in the rubber trade. They had their wives, or they sent for their girlfriends to become their wives, or they went back to Morocco and got married and brought them. But one way or another, the women started to come and set up a real community life very early. And they got along well with people. There was really, as far as I can tell, no issue getting along with people. And eventually, when the sugarcane trade and the rubber trade ran their courses, by that time, you know, they had become doctors and lawyers and teachers and, you know, salesmen and all the rest of it that you would expect people in any community to become.
Did they still have contact with Morocco?
Oh, yeah, because they kept coming. You know, a lot of the people that I met who are, say, in their 60s or 70s now, either their grandparents came, you know, within living memory, their living memory, or even sometimes their parents. Sometimes not. Sometimes their families had been there for generations and generations.
So why do you think that the women's music wasn't brought over, but the men's was?
Well, I'm sure it was brought over. I'm sure they came singing it. I don't know. It's something that I'm still working on, because there's no reason for it not to be. You know, they had weddings. And they kept some of the language, Hakatia, Moroccan Judeo-Spanish, going for quite a long time. Today, it's mostly single words and expressions. It's not really spoken. But that's the case, you know, with most descendants of Moroccan Jews. I was at a Zoom yesterday about Hakatia, and they were people speaking it, but they had been sought out by the people running the Zoom. You know, there's not that many people who speak it. But the Jacati in Brazil is kind of Brazilian Portugueseified. But for some reason, I don't know what the reason is, you know, these songs are very circumstantial. You sing them when you're doing something. You sing wedding songs when you're sewing the trousseau and preparing for the wedding. A lot of them have disappeared also in daily life in other Moroccan Jewish communities. The ballads, the old narrative ballads, again, they were sung usually in domestic circumstances. You're cooking, you're sewing, you're rocking the baby, you're sitting together, a bunch of women in the indoor patio of the house and singing these. So a lot of this repertoire has also disappeared in other Moroccan communities. But my sense is that it disappeared earlier in Brazil. And I don't really know why. I had a really amazing experience with the Shaliach Tzibur, the Chazan of the Manaus community, Isaac Tahan, Dr. Isaac Tahan, who's a doctor, medical doctor as well. And he's a wonderful singer. He's in his late 70s. And I heard him daven for Yom Kippur. I was in the synagogue this past Yom Kippur. And I arranged with him to meet him a couple of days later and record some of his repertoire. And he said to me, you know, I remember one wedding song. He said, my father was, you know, from the south of Morocco, the French and Arabic speaking part. But my mother was from Tetouan, from the Khakatiya speaking part. And mostly I learned my father and the men's repertoire in the synagogue. But I remember from when I was little, my mother singing this snippet of a wedding song, you know, Khakatiya, classic wedding song. And I can't remember more than a few words. And I said to him, well, tell me how it began and I'll see if I know it. So he sang the little phrase that he remembered and I sang him the whole song right away. And what was very touching and sweet is that he whipped out his iPhone, and I'd been filming him, of course, and then he whipped out his iPhone to film me. So I started again and sang the whole thing for him. And it was just kind of ironic, too, that, you know, an Ashkenazi Canadian woman had to be the one to basically give him back his mother's Moroccan Sephardic wedding song. I mean,
well, an Ashkenazi Canadian ethnomusicologist.
That too.
So is there anything else you can tell us about this project of the Moroccan Jews in the Amazon?
Well, one thing too is that they do sing a few Sephardic songs, Ladino songs, but they're from that very popular Ottoman, when I say Ottoman, I mean the countries that are today, you know, Turkey and Greece and the Balkans, that very popular sort of top 10 Sephardic hits repertoire that they learned later. They learned from people coming through and they've adopted them and they'll even sing them sometimes with, you know, adding local Brazilian rhythmic patterns and so on. So these are not songs from the Moroccan Jewish culture that their ancestors were from, but they're Ladino songs and they say, well, they're Sephardic songs and we're Sephardim, which is totally true. And they've absorbed them into their daily, you know, into the regular community repertoire.
Okay, so what about the other branch of what you're doing in Brazil about the music among the crypto Jews?
Right. So I started the Portuguese crypto Jewish project in the mid 90s. I'd had my PhD for a few years in Sephardic music, and I never stopped, as you know, doing research on that. But I asked myself, what about the Jews who never left? The Jews who stayed in especially Portugal, because historical circumstances were somewhat different, but I framed it as the Jews of the border area, because the border, you know, is an area where people went back and forth and crossed all the time for various reasons. So I thought, well, is there any music there among the crypto Jews that's different in any way from music of the region? So I started doing a fairly long-term project where I went to all the historically Jewish villages, not just the famous Belmonte there too, of course, but, you know, several. And I had to come to the conclusion that there was no different music. There were a couple of songs, there's a few songs in Belmonte, well, a few, there's two plus Hatikva, that are different, but the music isn't old. The music is not archaic at all. It's maybe late 19th, early 20th century. And one of them has old words. It's a Passover song about the crossing of the Red Sea. So at some point, they just set it to this maybe scouting type of song of the end of late 19th century. And the other is a kind of, I don't know what to call it, a happy Romeo and Juliet, happy ending Romeo and Juliet type song, which again doesn't seem to be from before the early 20th century. But other than that, and the music is regional music, it's nothing astonishing. Other than that, they don't seem to have any music. They have a lot of prayers, a lot of old prayers, and they recite them, and they recite them quietly and very quickly, probably so that they wouldn't be overheard, and, you know, they sound like women preparing the midday meal. So that's Portugal. And I thought, well, I'm here. I'm in Brazil. I've met all these people. And I started going to the synagogue that most of them go to, which is just today or yesterday celebrated its 99th anniversary, although it was beforehand an Ashkenazi synagogue, kind of changed over the years. And they have quite a different setup because, first of all, as I said, right now, if you wave your hands in an auditorium and say, hi, we're crypto Jews, then the element of secrecy is clearly not crucial. But there are others whom, of course, I didn't meet who don't come out in the open and so on. And a lot of work has been done on them, not on their music, but a lot of, there have been films, there have been articles, there's been a lot of research. Anita Novinsky, for example, who just passed away not long ago, I think in her very late 90s, and others. But I was specifically trying to look at music. So it's complicated because now they take it from everywhere, right? It's 30 years after I started my project in Portugal. There's, you know, all these years of internet and travelers and people coming through. So it's kind of hard to say. They seem, the ones I've met, and that's, you know, a tiny amount, a tiny percentage of the ones who exist, of course. The ones I met have learned a lot from different sources. One who passed away this past March learned Ladino, and he had started to write poetry in Ladino, but he didn't grow up speaking it. He learned it, you know, as a young adult. They learn, again, songs from different sources. They learn songs from me, for that matter. I gave them workshops. And then a lot of them also go to spiritist religious ceremonies. They might go to Umbanda or Jurema or Candomblé. And my colleague Alex Minkin, the one who introduced me to the professor in Recife, he's done a lot of work on that as an anthropologist. He's made films, so I just followed that up a very, very, very little bit, but there's a limit to what one person can do. And then there's one group in further north of Recife, a few hours north in Natal, and they have a tradition where they play the Rebeca, which is the old, it's the Brazilian adaptation of the old Portuguese Rebeca, which is in turn the medieval Rebec, which in Spain is the shepherd's Rabel, and it's pretty much disappeared in Portugal. But it's pretty popular still in Brazil, and it's having a big comeback. But they play it old school, and they sing the very old cattle herders' songs, which are this kind of melancholy-sounding, old, unaccompanied songs. And they set traditional Jewish piyutim, like famous ones, like Adon Olam, to this very old free rhythm tune, which it doesn't really fit metrically. So that was really interesting.
Who does this? Is this everybody or is this people? I mean, who sings these songs?
People.
I mean, are they Jewish?
No. Are the people Jewish or the songs Jewish?
No. You're saying that the songs are Jewish.
No. I'm saying, well, no. When I say song, I mean the combination of lyrics and music. So if I say lyrics, I just mean the lyrics. If I say song, I mean everything together. So there's the tune, and there's the lyrics, and then there's a song. So in a lot of these cases, the melody is not Jewish, the lyrics are, and the song is this combination, it's what we call contrafactum, of these lyrics set to this melody.
Yeah, but my question is, if these lyrics are Jewish, who is singing them?
Oh, the crypto-Jews, but they learned them as adults. They didn't grow up singing Adon Olam or any of the other piyutim. They learned them in their quest to become, I mean, they considered themselves Jewish already, but in their quest to, I don't know, to bring their Judaism more in line with, I don't even know what to call it, because there's no such thing really as normative Judaism, but you get the idea.
So did you find a relationship between what they're doing in Brazil and what you already found along the border between Spain and Portugal?
Not so much, because it seemed to me, and again, like, I'm at the beginning in Brazil, right? I you know, so everything I'm saying is with the caveat that I've been doing this for, what, 4 years now. and 4 or 5 years tops. And so I consider myself a real beginner. And Brazil is a huge, super complex, really, really complex country. And there's relationships with indigenous people and relationships with black and partly black people and relationships with all the other people who formed, you know, Brazil as a modern country too. And so it's just really the beginning. It's a little caveat. Portugal geographically is a tiny country. You can go anywhere in a few hours, you know, so it's a whole different thing. Plus, the Jews I interviewed in Portugal never left. They might have traveled a bit and come back, but they've basically been there since the Inquisition. So it's a really different thing. But yeah, they do. Some of the Jews in Portugal have adapted local tunes to sing the Jewish liturgy that they relearned starting in the late 19th, early 20th century when they were, quote, unquote, discovered. So there's similarities in that sense, but I'd say the ones that I met, at least those I know in Brazil, have a much wider musical life just because of the way Brasil works.
Tell us about the rezadeiras.
The rezadeiras are the women who were the prayer women, reza, as in prayers. And even the first European Jews who arrived in Belmonte over 100 years ago talked about the rezadeiras. So what started happening in Portugal is that the ritual observance of crypto-Judaism bit by bit passed to the women. At first it didn't, but, you know, little by little what happened is you had the men. First of all, you couldn't gather. You couldn't have large gatherings except in a Christian setting, right? So anything that was a prayer service could only be a very few people. Then you had the men who were often itinerant salesmen, vendors. And now you can go and come back to a market 30 kilometers away in half an hour. But then if you were walking or going by horse or donkey or whatever, it was going to take a long time. So you left the house for at least a week and came back. And you went to all these different fairs and markets and did your work and came back. So the women were home. And bit by bit, most of the ritual in Portuguese crypto-Jewish observance passed to the women. And Hebrew disappeared fairly early on. It's in Portuguese. And some of the prayers became really hybrid. I mean, there's been a lot of studies done on these. But it's not music. It's at some point, they stopped singing, a lot of them. We don't know when, because the Inquisition records do mention people singing. And at some point, they just kind of stopped mentioning different tunes. And no one conversa, scripto Jews who sang Jewish things. So at the very least, as far as I know, for the past 100-something years, they've been reciting these prayers rather than singing them. And my assumption is that it would have been too dangerous to sing something that was different. If it was dangerous to cook differently, eat differently, wash your clothes before Shabbat, all these things that very often your own servants, you know, the girls who worked in your house would denounce you, then imagine singing a different tune audibly would be really dangerous. You know, you may as well just not bother, just hand yourself in.
So is this something that is still being done in Portugal?
Most of the oldest rezadeiras that I met in the 1990s have passed away. And if they're doing it, they're doing it secretly again. And instead of hiding from inquisitors, maybe hiding from, you know, anthropologists and ethnomusicologists and the rabbis who have come in, you know, and stayed there. Actually, I shouldn't say none of them. It might be happening with some of the daughters and even granddaughters, but I don't think so, or very little anyway. But the ones who were the, you know, the daughters and the granddaughters and the great-granddaughters and the great-great-granddaughters of the old prayer women of, say, the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries, they've all passed away.
So you said that this is a fairly new project, what you're doing in Brazil. What are your next steps?
Well, I don't know, I'm getting kind of old, you know, chronologically speaking. So just on a realistic level, it depends how many more active years of traveling. Right now I'm not planning to stop traveling anytime soon, but, you know, when one's years sometimes tell one a different story. So I'm trying to figure out, you know, it's not free to go there. I have to get grants. I have to get research grants. The last trip I made, I went as an artist. I was invited to sing at a Jewish festival in São Paulo. So I got them to write letters of invitation in the Canada Council for the Arts accepted my application, which it doesn't always. So, and I did some concerts for the Cervantes Institutes and the Alliance Française in Brazil. So, you know, these trips also have to be funded. So I need to figure out the next project that will get me there for a bit.
Is there anything else you'd like to add that we might have left out?
Not well, except I sort of got addicted to Brazil, I have to say. I love Portugal. I really do. I've always felt curiously at home there. And, I mean, I've been coming to Spain for 54 years now, so I don't even think of it as traveling. People say, do you like Spain? I don't even think of it as like. It's just my other home. But Brazil got me in this really odd, like, instantaneous way. And it's kind of like an addiction. The music, the light, the colors, the people, I don't know, just something in the air. So I hope I get back soon. And I will say that all these communities were super welcoming to me. I do want to say that. They took care of me. I stayed in some of their homes. They took me around. They fed me. You can't go out as a woman alone at night in most Brazilian cities, and night starts early. Night is 5:30 or 6. And, you know, they made sure that I had things to do. I was with people. And they were really just totally lovely to me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSephora.com. See you next week.